Hi, Vanessa here. Are you a counselor, a therapist, or other type of licensed behavioral health clinician? If so, you may be interested in a book I wrote called Burnout, Self-Care for Behavioral Health Clinicians. Check it out at therapistassets.com, also known as VanessaLexShop.com.
This is Unraveled, and I'm your host, Vanessa.
My guest today, Kevin Peterson, owns Peterson Family Counseling located in Colorado, which he founded in 2014 and is now currently a group practice. Kevin specializes in working with families and individuals struggling with addictions, codependency, and parenting-related issues. Kevin's work experience includes, but is not limited to, working as an in-home therapist, case manager, crisis evaluator, and outpatient therapist. Thank you, Kevin, for being here with us today. I appreciate your time and your energy.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
So for starters, what motivated you to enter into the behavioral health care field in the first place?
Oh, that's a great question. So I am 27 years sober in 12-step AA recovery. And I was in sales and had always been in sales when I was drinking and then when I got sober. And I love helping people solve problems. And a good salesperson solves people's problems. And I was very successful at that. And what I ended up doing, I was 43 years old in 2007. I was 16 years sober and I was, you know, making six figures and driving a nice car and had a nice place to live. And I was really empty inside. And I sat down and talked to two of my friends, both in recovery, who had, you know, made career changes in their late 30s and early 40s. And one became a nurse and one became a therapist. And they both said the same thing. You know, if there's ever been someone who's a therapist, it's you, number one. And number two, part of what we're taught in the 12-step recovery world is that it's our responsibility to help other people. And my one friend said, I realize that doesn't mean just 1 hour a day in a meeting or on the occasional phone call. That has to be my life, helping others. And so I thought, yeah, I mean, everything he said just sung to me. And I was like, you're right, exactly. And so that's what sort of premeditated my applying to Regis University in Denver, Colorado, and quitting my job and jumping in with both feet, you know?
I remember hearing you on the Brighter Vision podcast, and I really liked your the episode that you were on, because you seemed really down to earth. And I was actually working at a really shitty agency job at the time. And, you know, I would listen to segments like yours in many cases more than once, the ones like that, like yours, I found really inspiring, because it really kept my head up and, you know, made me feel like better as I was doing, you know, too much paperwork that I didn't want to do.
I know that job.
I remember, you know, like I said, you seemed like a really decent human being, which we need more of in the world. And that's how you came across. And
really, it's working.
And I remember that you were talking about how you're very proactive and practical with your clients, and so am I. I feel like more so you and I than maybe a lot of clinicians out there. And I recall you mentioning something about when a client schedules a visit with you, that you're instructing them, you know, when they actually come to see you, that you're instructing them right away with practical steps, such as, I think you gave an example of reading a certain book and or taking a certain action to improve their situation immediately so that they can feel better about their problems, and like maybe they got a little bit more of a grasp on it as soon as they walk out, instead of, you know, 10 sessions later wondering what's going on. And so I was wondering, could you give us an example of like what book do you recommend that some of your people read, and like how do you take that proactive practical approach on a daily basis? Could you give some examples?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I mean, I got to sort of take a little bit of a step back and understand where that, if you don't mind me explaining where that philosophy comes from and why. I think people come to me as a therapist because they have a problem and they're looking for a solution to that problem. And I know for me personally, I had gone, I mean, I've been going seeing a therapist since I was 12 years old. And, you know, I grew up in Palo Alto, California, in a back when it was a town that nobody had heard of, by the way. And it was, you know, your typical upper
Silicon Valley.
Well, I mean, it was happening then, but it wasn't anywhere near what it is today. It was always a nice place to live, but it wasn't like the center of the universe. and as far as they're concerned, and, you know, what happened is I would go sit in these therapist's office and we would end up like doing the typical, so how does this make you feel or that kind of thing. And I thought, I'm going to kill myself. I don't want to be here. And, there were a couple of people in my life, a couple of therapists that, the one who actually sort of challenged me to get sober, it was because he took a step out and said, you have a problem and you need help. And I was like, you're right. And then in my first marriage, I saw an individual therapist who he said, you know, you can come here every week and bitch about your wife and your mother, or we could actually do some proactive stuff and make your life better. It's totally up to you. You know, I was like, you know, you're kind of a dick and I really like you. And, and then I had when my ex-wife and I were in couples therapy, our final couples therapist was like, you know, look, you guys, you got to see things. And this is not about chanting the magic words or, you know, burning the magic incense at the magic time. It's practical. You know, you're here because you have a problem. I want to offer you a solution. And one of you is trying to get to the solution. One of you isn't. So anyway, so the answer to your question is, I believe people come to therapy because they have a problem. They're looking for a solution. So I think it's really important to hand them a solution, at least something to triage what's going on in the moment and help them walk down that path. So if it's someone that's got dealing with substance abuse, I'm very big on getting them to, you know, read anything from. Well, I mean, I believe heavily in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, mm-hmm. My client, I'll tell them, you know, there's two ways to go about this. One, if you have a substance abuse issue and it's affecting your life, you know, let's come up with a plan of abstinence. And you also have to change your behavior. It's not just about not using, okay? So you can do that in a couple of different ways. You can go to the gym. You can go to church. You can be a Buddhist. You can start meditating. You can do all, or you can also try the 12-step world, you know? Mm-hmm. And I let them try it. And, you know, whatever you come up with. And then that's plan A. And plan B, if that doesn't work, and I don't mean 6 months later, I mean like in the next week, then we talk about treatment, okay? Mm-hmm. If someone's codependent and dealing with family issues, I immediately hit them with codependent no more, facing codependency. And then if I have someone who's just kind of struggling with life in general, I am a huge fan of Brené Brown's work. So I have them read Daring Greatly. I have them watch her TED Talks. You know, there's also... in 2014, there's a great YouTube that Jim Carrey did a commencement speech for Maharishi University in Iowa. And it is, I mean, it's not to sound cliche, but I'm tearing up thinking about it. He talks about, you know, making decisions in his life and following his passion and that his father didn't. And, you know, and it was just, whew, I mean... I watched this and I was just like, oh, yes, exactly. You know, he's like, wouldn't you rather be, what is he? He had a great phrase. He's like, wouldn't you rather be broke at something you love than rich at something that makes you miserable, you know, or something along those lines? And I was just like, yes, you know, and so. Long answer to a short question. And I also come from a business background where we would hire consultants and the consultants would come in, evaluate the company and say, this is what we think you should do. Mm-hmm. And I see that That's the kind of therapist I want to be. I want to be the kind of therapist that says, okay, here's what I see. Here's what I think you should do. And then, of course, we're obviously going to get into deeper conversations. But I think people come in with a primary issue, and you have to triage that issue right off the bat.
I do agree with you. I really like your approach. Like I said, you come off as very practical, very down to earth. And I think that's what many people are coming to therapy for. Mm-hmm. And something that's annoyed me for some time now is, you know, this attitude of almost like, you know, you have to use, you know, this specific therapy. You have to, you know, go to this specific training. And if you're not doing that, then you're not helping anyone. You're not competent and blah, you know, like all that. I mean, I've actually dealt with those kinds of spiels before. And, you know, research shows that the most important thing is the relationship between the therapist and the client, and that the therapist believes what they're doing is actually working. And I definitely think that you're probably helping people a lot more by taking the approach that you're taking. And it's just interesting hearing someone like yourself out in the world talking openly about that. And I think that there needs to be more talk about that in an open way, because a lot of people don't feel that therapy can help them, or that, you know, your therapist, or maybe there's a stereotype about it. And so you're very refreshing in your approach.
Thank you. A lot of my friends in recovery as well say they've gone to therapists over and over and over again, and they don't know anything about 12-step recovery, or they were going to see them when they were still using, and they were bullshitting the therapist, because the therapist would never say, hey, when's the last time you got high, you know, or, you know, because they were trying to meet them where they were at. And, you know, they were like, I want accountability. I want someone to say, you need to, before you come back, I want to see a drug test, you know, and that's what they're looking for. So that's where I come from. And I understand that there's a need for the processing therapy as well, that the, you know, where somebody just needs to be heard and engaged with. And I totally value that. I just, the world that I live in is much more solution focused, and people are coming in looking for, I mean, couples therapy is inherently solution focused. People are coming in because the couple is not getting along and they need help, you know?
I agree with you. So what would you say to those out there, which I know is a fact, there's many people out there that are struggling with some type of substance abuse issue, and you specifically have mentioned 12-step programs multiple times already in this interview, and you mentioned basically the peer support substance abuse groups, which, just for those listening that may not know, peer support groups like Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous or some other related peer support group that's, you know, formed and separate, there's many of them these days. It's not a clinical group. It is a peer support group for people with similar problems, such as yourself, that may be in recovery as well, or in different stages, to provide you the support you need and help you build long-lasting relationships that are conducive to your recovery. And so those are some of the key differences. Now, for those listening that are rolling their eyes in the back of their head, potentially, that may be in a situation where they are struggling with a substance abuse issue, maybe they know it, maybe they don't, and maybe have heard other people say, you really need to go AA, or you really need to go NA, or you really should go to the support group. And they're like, I don't need that. This, you know, let's just say they're saying this, I don't need that. Those people have real problems, and I don't. My issue is not that bad. I don't need to be there. That's not helpful. What would you say to people like that, you know, that have that mentality?
You know, that is a great question, because I get that all the time. You know, I'm only here because so-and-so said I had to be. And my response is really direct. Oh, okay, great. So if you don't need to be here, don't be here. You know, I mean, if you don't feel like you need therapy, or you don't need any help, you know, so I'm big on sort of, I guess, what I would call politely challenging that negativity, or I forgot the clinical word, but you know, the
resistance,
that's the word, politely challenging the resistance, and just looking them in and saying, well, why do you think your mom sent you in here? And they're like, and they look at me like, well, you know, I got my second DUI. Oh, okay. Do you think it's a problem? No. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, really? So let's walk through this together. I mean, I guess this is really traditional motivational interviewing.
I was just thinking that.
And, but you know, And then if I can get them to acknowledge that, I mean, generally if they come to my office, they're acknowledging that they have a problem. And then the next thing out of their mouth is, but I'm not going to that stupid AA stuff. It doesn't work.
Exactly.
And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. You know, I guess my 27 years is just a fantasy, you know? and I say, okay, great. No problem. What's your plan? You know, I don't want to talk down to them, and I don't want to speak down from the mountaintop. I want to say, okay, how are you going to stay sober? I said, like I said, here are the two things that you got to do. You got to stay sober, and your life has to get better. So how are you going to do that? And I totally support whatever plan they come up with. You know, honestly, in the 4 years of doing this, I've had one person look me in the eye and say, I am a devoutly religious man. I'm deep into my church, and I'm deep into the service structure of my church, and it worked for him. Okay. Everybody else literally has started off with, I'm going to do yoga. I'm going to, you know, go to therapy. I'm going to take medication, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, great. So that'll keep you sober. How are we going to change the way you live? And inevitably what ends up happening is one of two things happen. They fail and they just fail because they just do, you know, because what they're trying to do is willpower it. And that's what got them into my office in the first place, is that that's not working. Okay. And so then it's like, okay, well, let's try all your options. Let's try yoga. Let's try working out. Let's try more therapy. Let's try reading more books. You know, and maybe sometimes those things will catch, you know, and maybe sometimes those things will work. But almost inevitably, I would tell you in about 90% of my cases, they come back and they're like, okay, this isn't working. I'm like, okay, great. Are you willing to try, just try one of the 12-step support groups? That's all I'm asking. Just try. And, you know, what ends up happening is one of two things. They end up going and realizing it isn't so bad and the people aren't awful and that they actually fit in, you know, or they'd never show up again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'm huge on peer support substance abuse groups, whether it be 12-step or another one. Some, I know that certain religious organizations have their own substance abuse or addiction support groups, peer support groups, which works for some people, not everyone, obviously. And then I know that, I don't want to bring up what organization is because I'm not a big fan of the organization, but there's a large organization that caters to a certain demographic.
Yeah.
And they are offering, and I don't like the organization, but they're offering a peer support group for substance abuse just recently and increasingly so. And I really like the concept. I think it's excellent. It is a great option for people in the community, and it's providing a safe location and meeting environment. And one of the reasons I'm so huge on peer support groups is because the reality is that therapy is and should be time limited, and the whole purpose of it is to increase the person's functioning in their life. And we can't go home with them or go out with them or be their friend for the rest of their life, but yeah. They can go to these groups and meet people that can, you know,
that
they can have a different kind of relationship with long term. And that helps build that support group long after therapy ends, and that can sustain the recovery. And I get a lot of resistance. I've worked in a number of different settings just to keep in mind, and I try not to go on my tangents. And so I've worked in crisis center, hospital, opioid treatment program. And so I've worked in a lot of different settings. And what I see time and again, and I dealt with horrific management, by the way, in the different settings. So, like, they're not supportive at all of staff and clients. And so what I've seen, though, is a lot of resistance with a number of clients that will be like, oh, I went and those people, so it's usually the way they say it, those people have serious issues and I don't. Yeah. I don't belong there, you know. And then I've heard this countless times, you know, it was almost like the exact words over and over and over again. And so then I suggest, because I've actually got like, I find the apps that people can download on their phone and I print it out. Like, I'm super user friendly. Anyways, yeah. And I'm like, okay, there's more than one meaning, like try another one, try another one. Like they all have their different personality, you know, maybe you'll find another one. And oftentimes that works. But then I find that some people are just like that, their heels dug in where they may want to come to therapy because they think you have like pixie dust and a magic fairy wand to fix their problems, but they don't want to like do anything outside of therapy really that could improve their situation. Like, you know, a peer support substance abuse group as one example. So, yeah, it's just kind of interesting kind of navigating that, you know, with every different
person. And I totally agree with you. I mean, I always tell, I had like three or four new clients this week where I looked at them and I said, I know what you want. You want a magic pill that's going to make everything all better. And they're like, yeah, do you have that? I'm like, if I did, I wouldn't be talking to you. You know, that was always, I worked at a community mental health support or community mental health agency in what was called the Arapahoe Douglas Mental Health for 3.5 years. And the psychiatrist, you know, I was in child and family services, and the psychiatrist and I, we always had this joke. It's like, do you have the magic pills? Who has the magic pills? You know, we got to fix these kids, and the parents want magic pills. And, you know, they're just, there is no such thing. And the thing is, I've also gotten to the point where I don't argue with people. If they don't want to go, great, don't go. There's nothing, you know, I mean, there's nothing better than their consequences to make them come back and be like, all right, I'll try it now. And you know, and then they,
yeah.
And then they come back and they're like, you know, those people, they're really quite nice. And I'm like, yeah, dummy, I told you that, you know. And you know, and I don't care. I mean, I used to be the guy that was like, you know, trying to negotiate with people. And now I'm like, yeah, whatever. You don't want to go? Don't go. I don't care. That's your, that's your problem, you know? And cause here's, what I will say is I'll look them in the eye and say, let me tell you what's coming down the road. Okay. Mm-hmm, that job you have. Yeah. That's gone. You don't need that. You know, that love, that family you have, that's out, you know? That car, no, that'll be gone. Your partner, your spouse, whatever, that's out, you know, because the drugs and the alcohol are going to become more important. And, you know, I mean, I'm just really direct. And, you know, the thing is, and you have to, I mean, this is the thing, especially when it comes to working in this environment, right, is that we're dealing with life and death.
True. You know?
And I always tell families, you know, if it's alcohol and marijuana, I'm willing to have a little wiggle room and sort of let them prove me right over time, you know. But
that can be dangerous too, because like the alcohol, if they become dependent, you know, just the risk involved in that too, you know.
Yeah, I totally get what you're saying. When I say give a little wiggle room, I mean a couple of
weeks. I understand.
Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to like, I mean, they have to prove it themselves. Yeah. But when it comes to meth, cocaine, opiates, benzos, heroin, I'm a no wiggle room guy. I'm a no bullshit guy. It's like, no. You're using heroin. You need to go to treatment today, because people that use drugs like that, they end up in one of three places: dead, prison, or sober. Those are the choices, and those are the choices, and they're never going to change, you know?
I agree. I've worked with a lot of people in those situations, and you know, now I'm in private practice. I actually have say so over everything versus when I worked for other people. I deal with bad managers that made decisions that were not clinically relevant. So I dealt with people and really got to observe in some cases like the downhill spiral, you know, the final downhill spiral. Yeah. And, you know, I saw some crazy stuff, but you know, with women in particular, it's like a guarantee that they will end up in some form of prostitution once it escalates far enough, even it's like the sugar daddy, sugar baby stuff, which has become the evolution of it, I've noticed with the websites. And so like a lot of women, when they're like really addicted and dependent to these drugs and they're, you know, really far downhill already, they'll be like, you know, and they have no job, no support system, and they're like on the streets already, you know, it's pretty far advanced. You know, they'll be like, oh, I don't have sex for money. I just have this guy that like pays for my stuff. And, you know, but they're describing prostitution, like the definition of prostitution, but they're like, I don't have, you know, I'm not that. And so it's like almost like this denial too. of, you know, when people get to that point. And then eventually it could take years. You know, some people manage to survive somehow. But yeah, you're right. Eventually, you know, you're going to die from the complications of drug use.
Yeah.
Or a drug deal gone south, you know.
Or who knows what. I mean, you put yourself in situations that you have no control over, and you put yourself in danger and harm's way. And, you know, either, you know, Darwin is going to handle things, the judicial system is going to handle things, or, you know, you're going to wake up and be like, I need help, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you were like, I thought I was the most blunt person, most blunt therapist out there. No, it's official. I think you may be the most blunt therapist out there. Brutally honest. That's true. Yeah, because I'm pretty brutally honest too. Anyways, maybe give me another 10, 20 years. Maybe I'll get there.
Well, anyway. you know what it is? You get to a point in life, you know, you get married, you get divorced, you know, you do whatever you do long enough, and you're just like, I just don't have time to dance with you. You know, yeah. This is bullshit. You know, you're going to fucking die, you know, and I don't want you to die. I mean, and that's the other side of it too, is I'm 54 and I don't like going to funerals. I don't like reading about that stuff.
I've refused to go to funerals. Yeah. That's too much for me.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, that's just the nature of the beast. You just get to a point where you're like, yeah, I'm not doing this. This is stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and I want you to get better. And if you don't want to get better, and that's the other thing, is if you don't want to get better, great. You don't got to be here. This is a strictly voluntary process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love when my clients walk in and I'm like, so how's it going? And they're like, oh, everything's great. I'm like, why are you here?
Yeah.
You could have canceled this appointment. And they're like, well, no, I mean, you know, you know, I'm going to court Friday. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, let's talk about that.
On a lighter note, but also I guess equally heavy. So on a lighter note, I was on your website, which is very functional and well put together. I say that because not all therapist websites fit into that category.
Yeah, that's the truth. Everyone thinks it's their chance to be an artist. And I'm like, no, I'm selling a product.
I do, you know, if you're a really great digital artist and graphic designer, then great. But I know as a fact that most clinicians that I've come into contact with, as well as their websites have come into contact with, are not. So, I do my fair share of graphic design, digital art. I don't know how I ended up doing that, but I do. And I really appreciate great design. And I noticed that your family recovery programs, I wouldn't call it a flyer and I wouldn't call it a brochure because it's like way nicer than that. But the information for the event is really well designed. It's really nice. I mean, there's not quite words I can put into because I'm looking at it right now. And it's just like, it just looks really good. And I really appreciate good design. And so I was wondering, did you design this yourself? Because it looks great.
No. One of the things that I learned in the corporate America is hire people that are good at what they do. Don't try to do stuff yourself. You know? And so, you know, ironically, I found a girl in Atlanta who her mother is a therapist and she's a graphic designer. And I actually on a Facebook page, I put, and I said, hey, does anybody know a great graphic designer? And this one therapist in Atlanta said, yeah, my daughter. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, sure. Oh, my God, she's amazing. You know?
Yeah. Would you mind sharing her name so I can put it in the
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I mean, I think any therapist listening to this would need – check it out. Okay, you probably need the help.
Yeah, her name is Sydney Smith.
Okay, and I'll put that in the – podcast description information as well. Does she have a website or just a Facebook page? Or
well, she actually works full time as a graphic designer for like a corporation, so she does this on the side. But what I can do is I'll email you her contact information and I'll send you like a hello email, and because she's always happy to work with people, you know, that's not an issue. But I always just say, hey Sydney, my friend needs to talk to you, and my friends are always like, oh yeah, sure, and then I get a phone call like, oh my God. You know, and she's very affordable. I mean, like crazy affordable, you know?
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, a lot of behavioral health clinicians really do need the help. And I, you know, I just saw recently a brochure as I think about it, as I look at your event here, your event graphics, and it was really bad. It was, you know, the text, like yours is very clear and organized and like readable and it doesn't hurt my eyes. This looked like the smallest print possible crammed into like whatever space available. Mm-hmm. And it was like painful to read and I have excellent vision. And so I was just thinking like that is an example of someone who could really use these services and maybe they don't even realize it. I don't know if they don't realize they have a problem here.
No.
Tell me more about the family recovery programs that I'm looking at with the event event designs here.
Yeah.
Because it looks really interesting and I don't see this as very common with many clinicians doing, you know, these types of events.
Sure. So I put that together in 2015 at the request of a local 90-day extended care service program, substance abuse program. And what I did is I took a look at what – so again, taking a step back. I love working with addicts and alcoholics. I live for working with the family members. Okay. That is my passion, is getting the family in the room without or with the addict and getting them to understand that they're just as sick as the addict. Okay. And that it's a family systemic issue. Yes, the addict is using, no question about it. But the family has probably spent years accommodating that or turning a blind eye to it. And now it's gotten so painful that they want help. And so I see it as, I mean, it's the classic stuff they taught us in grad school, right? You have the identified patient, but the truth is behind the identified patient is an entire system of dysfunction that has to be addressed. You know, because the worst thing we can do is take an addict, sober them up, give them a new way of life, and throw them back into the same family system.
You know? And then you mentioned the book Codependency No More, yep. And what you're just talking about. And I was just thinking about that, how codependency enables a lot of this behavior. If you're bailing someone out of jail constantly, and if you're basically solving the problems that are coming from all the substance abuse, you know, and enabling it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of where that came from, was the idea of, you know, saying, let's do a 2-day weekend seminar where we get the family members to fly in. And, you know, it's broken into 4 parts. You know, the first part is what we have to do is agree on a common language and about addiction and recovery. And the places that we were, it was a 2-day seminar that we sold into treatment programs. Okay. So the morning of the first day is very much about understanding this is what addiction is in a 12-step model. So our definition of addiction is once I start, I can't stop. It doesn't matter what it is. And armed with that knowledge that I have that propensity, I can't not start, you know, and that's always the thing is that people, you know, they don't understand that when you get hit by a train, it's not the caboose that kills you. You know, it's the engine. It's the first drink. It's the first pill. It's the first whatever. That's what gets you, you know, that drives you into the hole and then finishes you off. And so we have to get rid of the first one. We don't have to worry about the 20th drink. We got to worry about the first drink. And then helping them understand the 12 steps of recovery and where they come from and why and how they work, which honestly, in 4 years of doing 3.5 years of doing this program, every single time we do it, the family members are like, this is my kid's 5th treatment and nobody's explained the 12 steps to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, right, exactly. Let's get practical. I want you to understand when your kid comes home or your family member comes home, I want you to understand what they're talking about and why they need to keep going to meetings. And that's definitely what happens. And then in the afternoon of the first day, we turn the tables on them and we start talking about codependency in the exact same process. So let's define codependency. You know, what's a codependent? What's enabling? What does that look like? You know, and, you know, it's definitely, there's definitely resistance from the family members because they're like, I don't have a problem. He has a problem. You know, and so we have to break that wall down and get everybody to understand that in order for the family to heal, everybody has to recover, not just one person. And then in the second day, we get deep into I'm a big fan of, you know, using some of Brené Brown's TED Talks and explaining guilt, shame, and vulnerability and the role that those things have in family dynamics and in addiction and codependency, you know. And then we do some pretty basic communication skills, you know, speaker, listener, and that sort of thing, and really get it across to them that, hey, you know, the most important thing you can do coming away from this weekend is realize that, yes, your family member is an addict and they need to deal with their stuff, but so do you. And that is because they always want to know, well, what can I do to help him stay sober or help her stay sober? And the best answer to that question is take care of your own stuff. You know, mm-hmm. address your own issues. And they just kind of look at you like, no, you didn't hear me. You know, I'm like, oh no, I heard you. You know, and I always, they kind of like, you know, I always say, you know, look, I know that you want to spend the rest of your life planning for the zombie apocalypse to occur, but the truth of the matter is your family members in treatment, they're fine. You know, what we need to do now is really approach and address how the family system is going to change, not just one person. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's challenging work, to be totally blunt with you, because codependents don't think they have a problem. They think they make the trains run on time.
Mm-hmm. You know, no, I understand.
Yeah.
I see on this event graphic mm-hmm. that a man named Chris, a clinician,
yeah.
Is doing this with you. How did you guys meet, and how many of the family recovery programs have you guys run together?
So I started the program in 2015 in June, and then quickly I sold it into two different treatment centers here in Colorado. And so I was doing it twice a month, and it was very successful. And I had to hire contractors, and it quickly became more than one person could manage. And Chris, mm-hmm. Chris and I had met because Chris is a certified sex addiction therapist as well as a licensed professional counselor. Mm-hmm. And I was very impressed with him and his business skills and his understanding of addiction and sex addiction specifically, which was something that I did not have a lot of knowledge of. And mm-hmm. So I wanted to compliment that. And he's one of those type A, highly organized people. And just between you and me, I'm not. So
do you see people coming into these family recovery program two-day events with sex addiction as well, yeah. or is it just substance abuse?
It's all of the above. It can be literally, it can be all process addictions. It can be substance abuse. I mean, whatever the case may be. And so anyway, he and I started talking, and I was like, look, I need a partner. I need help. I can't, you know, my wife's like, hey, you know, you're doing two weekends a month plus your private practice, and I'm really happy that you're successful and you're making money, but, you know, I would like it if you were home. you know, families always wanting the people to be home. and so
yeah. How many of the family recovery programs do you think you've done total?
Let's see. You know, so we're doing two a month. So that's 24 a year and 3 years.
Wow.
So 72.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is a lot more than what I anticipated. So you got this down to science by now, I would imagine. This podcast isn't going to post for a while because I have it scheduled out. Mm-hmm. But if someone is interested in participating in a family recovery program that you're running, what would be the best way to sign themselves up for that or to let other people know that this is happening?
Sure. The best way would be to contact me directly on my website. You can either text me, call me, or send me an email, and I can tell you when the next one is available. And we're trying to scale it. So right now it's really just available in treatment centers that we work with. But we're not. Uh-huh. But we are also capable of taking it on the road, and being able to do individual work with families if they need it. We can do video sessions. We can do phone sessions. Chris has actually moved to Arkansas, and I'm in Denver, and so we have the capacity to work with individual families in this situation or groups. If there was a group, or whether it was a treatment center or a church group or a faith group or a whatever group that was like, hey, we really need this, we would be happy to provide that service.
All right. And which website should they go to visit to contact you?
Peterson Family Counseling, .com. And the most important part about that is Peterson is spelled P-E-T-E-R-S-E-N. Not O-N.
Okay. And I see here on the event, it says that there's a website for the event as well, specifically. Is that correct?
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And they can go to that one as well. It's familyrecoveryprogramsplural.com.
All right. And as we go through this information, all of it will be included in the podcast description as well. So you can print it out or you can click directly to that information. So what motivated you to enter into private practice? You know, I know that you used to work for other people. So what made you make that leap?
Yeah. And let me tell you how much I enjoyed working for other people. I knew going to graduate school that there was going to be a period of time where I had to get my hours, to get supervision, to get my license. And that I was going to have to, and the best way to do that was working in a community mental health facility where, you know, I mean, you got more hours than you could eat, you know, it was, and so there were a couple of things that motivated me. One, and I'm going to be totally honest, and I think it's, people need to stand up and say this, and it's totally okay to say, I was working full time as a therapist, not licensed, but as a master's level therapist, full time for Arapahoe Douglas Mental Health, and I was making $38,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And that, by the way, is an increase over the average therapist because I speak Spanish. And so I got a pay bump for that. And I worked on the side at the psych unit that group owned. And so if you look at my taxes, I was actually making about $43,000 to $45,000 a year. And I'm sorry, I can't survive on that. You know, mm-hmm. I can't pay my loans on that, you know.
Right. Because a lot of people are graduating LA schools with mountains of student debt,
yeah.
Depending on where they attended or what their financial circumstances may have been. And a lot of people, if they're listening to this and are not clinicians themselves, may be unaware of the high cost of getting licensed, paying for supervision potentially, paying for licensing fees. There's a lot of costs paying for exams that you have to take to get licensed. Mm. A lot of people fail those exams and have to retake them. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of headache. And it takes years to get licensed. You know, I am 4 years in roughly, and I still have not finished up my primary license because of there's a lot of regulatory requirements. And, you know, it's really hard to navigate in a lot of states.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these agencies, you know, we talked before we started recording, they're making millions of dollars. Honestly, even the government agencies may have large bonuses for their managers. And then they're paying so little and oftentimes are breaking labor laws, engaging in discriminatory practices, creating toxic work environments, not paying people for the hours worked and requiring them as a condition of employment to work for no compensation outside of their normal scheduled hours. And this is really rampant. I've seen it and I've experienced it. And so those are some of the things that motivated me to go into private practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, definitely there was the financial piece, but there was also the piece of, I wanted to sort of be able to work with the clientele that I felt like I could be most effective with. I mean, I was serving a Medicaid population, which was great. And by the way, I got most of my clientele were Hispanic, and I really loved working with them, and I really enjoyed that process dealing with that. So there was a socioeconomic group of, and especially people that were maybe not legally here, and I loved being there and helping them. Oh my God, that was wonderful. I did not like the layers of bureaucracy. I did not like being told how to dress. I did not like being told how I could speak. And that's just not me. You know, I am very much me. And you know, it was apparent. My boss was like, you know, you're great. I mean, I was working on a crisis team that would do evals in the ER. And she's like, you know, you're fantastic. You love it. You enjoy working with these people. And she's like, you know, but you got to know in a big corporate structure, you don't fit in. I'm like, oh yeah, no, there's no way I'm going to fit in here. You know, I open my mouth. I say what I think. I mean, that's why I'm good at the crisis work. It doesn't make me a good corporate employee, you know?
Me too.
Yeah.
I agree with you totally.
So now, you know, I can decorate the office the way I want to. I bring my 2.5-year-old Boston Terrier to work every day. You know, his name's Bert. He sits on the couch and then sits on people's laps and, you know, and people love him and I love him and he's great. And if I go to work without him, I get the stink eye, you know, and the clients are like, where's the dog? I'm like, oh, he had to go, you know, to the vet. And they're like, huh? Okay. I'm like, I'm the therapist. you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, all those things that you mentioned about the rules and the policies of these different organizations frequently do not support good clinical outcomes. Yeah. They're not designed to support good clinical outcomes for clients. And that's really unfortunate. So what have your experiences been overall since entering into private practice? And also want to ask, I know that you've hired a number of people. Yeah. And so did you go the independent contractor route or the employee route? And how did you make the leap to hiring people? Because that's kind of scary. It's a big, big jump.
So yeah, first things first, I, you know, I went through the process with the state of Colorado to become a marriage and family therapy candidate. I got my hours, got my supervision, got my license. I kind of got to the point, you know, when I got pushed by a couple of friends that were like, why are you still working for somebody else? You're too good. And I was like, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. And they're like, is there anything that would stop you today from having a 1 day a week private practice? I'm like, no. So what I did was I rented a space for 1 day. I printed some business cards. I was fortunate that I had a bunch of friends that are like, let me help you. And they did all the paperwork for me. They did the LLC. They, you know, gave me a free website. I mean, I was just, the doors opened. Okay. And so I got that all squared away and I opened up my doors in April of 2014, 1 day a week. That day filled with 6 clients in the first month.
That's so impressive that you had such a great support system around you to help you get up off the ground so quickly.
Yeah, it went really That's fast. Really and then,
yeah.
And then, so that was April 2014. So then May of 2014, I opened up an evening and a Saturday afternoon. Those filled with another 6 clients in May. So now I'm seeing 12 clients a week privately, making more money than I'm making in the public sector. And so I went into my boss's office in June of 2014 and said, he's like, hey, how's your private practice? And I'm like, I'm glad you asked. I quit. And he and I were friends. And he's like, oh, no. I'm like, yeah, I really, it's time. So in August of 2014, I went full-time private practice. And I have to be honest with you, I've been very blessed and very fortunate that I've never had less than a full docket, you know. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean never less than like 16 clients a week, you know. Mm-hmm. And I attribute that to a couple of things. One, I run it like a business. So, you know, when I first opened, I was not the most expensive guy in the room. I was willing to take what other people were willing to give, you know, because I'd rather have my room filled with people paying me half to two-thirds of what I would, you know, my list price is, than having no one show up or one person show up at full price. That just doesn't make any sense. That's not good math, you know? Mm-hmm. And then what happened is that I got established, and then one of the local treatment centers came to me and said, hey, we'd like you to be our family therapist on a contract basis. Would you be interested? And I was like, I'd love to. So I immediately started doing work. And it kind of naturally gravitated my practice towards working with families of addicts and families of alcoholics, and then individually working with addicts and alcoholics as well, because that's my background. It's where I come from. It's my natural stuff. And I get it, you know. So, private practice has been very, very good to me. And then therapists can only work. I mean, I didn't get into this to work 40 hours a week and see clients 40 hours a week. My head would blow up. And
I agree. I understand. Yeah, it's intense work.
Oh my God.
And also one thing I'd like to say to any of those listening, may get misconception about the comment you made about, you know, the public agency or whatever that you worked at and that you quit. So a lot of people don't realize, and something I didn't know until I got into the so-called not-for-profit world and government world, is that, you know, frequently the clients are being charged just as much as if they went to private practice, yet the clinician is not actually being compensated accordingly, but the agency owners are. And, you know, and then they're getting worked to death and burned out. And so that's something that I've seen, and that one of the places I saw it at, they actually prohibited people from opening private practices, or because they try to keep them on a lockdown, you know, and keep them trapped. And they paid them such meager wages that they were literally were trapped.
Yeah, no, I get exactly what you're saying. And so I had been working for myself, and then doing the family recovery business and that sort of thing with Chris, and that was going really, really well. And then I only worked 3 or 4 days a week. I mean, I really only worked 3 days a week in my office, but I was paying, you know, I have an office that I rent for 7 days a week. So I was subletting it and getting, you know, just charging like $100 a month for a day. And another friend of mine was like, I don't understand why you don't have contractors. You give referrals all day, every day. Aren't there people that would be willing to give you a percentage of the income and work out of your office if you gave them referrals? And I was like, you know, I think you're right. I think that's really the model I need to roll to. And so I did. I started that in April of this year. And I have 3 people now that work for me. And they're each seeing like 3 or 4 clients a week of people that I've delivered to them. And, you know, we agree upon a certain percentage. And, you know, again, I run it like a business. I run it like a sales force. It's like, hey, you know what? If you see 1 or 2 people a week, here's the percentage. If you see 3 people a week, here's the percentage. If you see 4 or 5 people a week, you know, you get more money. You know, I'm not looking to be the landlord that beats people up for money. It's like, no. I want you to be able to make money. I mean, no one's going to stay if I'm taking all the cash. That's stupid, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And so I would much rather they get, you know, 60, 70 or 80% of the income. If they're seeing, you know, 4 or 5 people a day or 6 people a day, that's a huge victory for me, you know, mm-hmm. and for them.
And so do they set the rates or do you set the rates for the clients that they see, or how's that work?
Well, since they're not employees, so I have no authority to set any of that stuff.
Okay.
They're contractors. Now, you know, there's a going rate in Denver, you know, and so it's,
yeah,
you know, you got to be realistic, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, one of them's unlicensed, the other 2 are licensed, and, you know, so, you know, I tell them, and I'm like, look, I'm totally flexible. If you feel like you want to give somebody a different, you know, make a, you know, accommodation for somebody's financial situation, I have no issues with that, you know? So, yeah.
Got it. Yeah. Sounds like things have been really smooth for you. So that's awesome. It's been a great interview. It's been good to learn from you. So how can people find out more about the work that you do overall and where to find you if they want to work with you or want to refer someone to you that they think would be a good fit?
Yeah, I welcome calls from anyone about anyone and anywhere. You know, I do. So the best way to get a hold of me is my email is info@petersonfamilycounseling.com. And my phone number is 720-541-6289. And my website is www.petersonfamilycounseling.com. And, you know, we do all sorts of work. You know, we can do video sessions, we can do phone sessions, you know, we can do case management, we can do treatment consulting, and, you know, we can do traditional in the office therapy, but we're across the board. So if somebody's in another state and they're like, gosh, I wish there was somebody like that in my state, give me a call. Well, maybe we can figure something out.
Sounds good. And for those of you listening, all of Kevin's information will be in the podcast description below. You can print it out, you can click through, or you can rewind this and listen and write it down from what Kevin said. If you're listening to this podcast right now on social media platform of some kind, then I will link back to Kevin in at least 1 or more of the posts so you can easily find him on social media if that's more convenient for you, and then find his website from there. All right. Thank you, Kevin, for your time and for your expertise. I greatly appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for your time. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this stuff. This thrills me to no end. And I think what you're doing is amazing. So I appreciate you allowing me onto your situation.
Thank you.